Hey, welcome to the Growth Dummy book summary of Nonviolent Communication by Marshall B. Rosenberg. Nonviolent communication shows us how to have healthy relationships through openly and honestly communicating our observations, feelings, needs, and requests. This book can help us move past dysfunctional communication habits we learned growing up, including guilt tripping, being passive aggressive, blaming, labeling, and judging others as good or bad. Our top quote from this book is, "Most of us grew up speaking a language that encourages us to label, compare, demand, and pronounce judgments rather than to be aware of what we are feeling and needing." End quote. Now, this book was first published in 1999. So, first lesson, why learn nonviolent communication? To avoid speaking in hurtful and ineffective ways. The author of this book is psychologist Marshall Rosenberg. One time he was in a mosque in Bethlehem, standing in front of 170 Palestinian Muslim men and presenting his teachings about nonviolent communication. All of a sudden, there was a disturbance in the crowd. The men began whispering furiously to each other. Rosenberg's translator told him tensely, "They're whispering that you're an American." And then a man in the crowd jumped to his feet, pointed at Rosenberg, and yelled as loud as he could, "Murder!" About a dozen other men joined in, calling him a child killer and assassin. You see, this group of Palestinian men felt a lot of anger towards America for supplying tear gas and other weapons to Israel, weapons that were used against the Palestinian people. So, faced with this angry crowd, what do you think Marshall Rosenberg did? What would you have said and done in this situation? Rosenberg immediately focused on the first man who yelled, focusing on what that man was feeling and needing at that moment. He asked the man, "Are you angry because you would like my government to use its resources differently?" And the man replied, "Damn right I'm angry," and yelled that they didn't need American tear gas and what they needed were sewers and better housing. The man talked about how miserable living conditions were for him and his family, how his son had to play in sewage and the classrooms had no books. And Rosenberg replied, "I hear how painful it is to raise your children here. You'd like me to know that what you want is what all parents want for their children, a good education, opportunity to play and grow in a healthy environment." And this conversation continued like this for another 20 minutes, with the man expressing his pain and Rosenberg reflecting back the man's feelings and needs. Rosenberg didn't agree or disagree, but aimed to make the man feel understood. And in less than an hour, the same man who'd yelled murder was now inviting the American psychologist to his home for a Ramadan dinner. This story really illustrates the power of nonviolent communication. Nonviolent communication, or NVC for short, is a framework created by Marshall Rosenberg to help us better express our feelings and needs to other people and to make other people that we talk to feel understood by us. Now, I know most of us would never say that we talk to others in a violent way. Nonetheless, when we use the habits of communication that we picked up while growing up, we do often cause hurt and pain to both ourselves and the people that we're speaking to. In any disagreement, people often have knee-jerk strategies of getting their needs met, and these often include judging, blaming, and criticizing the other person. Now, this usually just makes the other person defensive, upset, or angry. But through nonviolent communication, we can learn to express our emotions and desires more directly. This means we can move past interpersonal friction and conflicts more smoothly and reliably. A summary of this first lesson: most of us don't believe that we talk in a violent way, but our words do often hurt people. Nonviolent communication is a framework to help us express our feelings and needs without judging, blaming, or criticizing others, which makes them defensive. It also shows us how to make others feel understood, which diffuses conflict. Now, lesson two. Don't judge others. It's an ineffective communication strategy. The first communication strategy that we should absolutely avoid is morally judging others as good or bad. This often happens when people have some disagreement or conflict. We spend a lot of time judging, labeling, and classifying the other person as being bad or good. For example, we might say, "That was selfish," or "Why are you so lazy?" or "Why don't you consider people around you?" Here's a quote from the book. Our attention is focused on classifying, analyzing, and determining levels of wrongness rather than what we and others need and are not getting. Thus, if my partner wants more affection than I'm giving her, she is needy and dependent. But if I want more affection than she is giving me, then she is aloof and insensitive. End quote. We judge and criticize because we are trying to make the other person behave differently to get our own needs met. But all that happens, usually, is the other person becomes defensive, upset, or angry. Trying to make others behave differently by making them feel bad, guilty, or ashamed just doesn't work most of the time, so it's best to avoid moral judgments in our communications altogether. Instead, focus on finding out what all people involved are feeling and needing in this moment. In summary, criticism and moral judgments are ineffective attempts at getting our needs met, but making someone feel bad or guilty doesn't work. It's more likely to create defensiveness, resistance, and resentment. Now, lesson three. Don't blame others. Be responsible for your own feelings and actions. So, another ineffective communication strategy we have is blaming others for how we feel or what we did. Sometimes we speak in a way that denies our own self-responsibility and implies we had no choice. For example, when we say, "Stop making me angry." Well, the truth lies in recognizing the fact that outside things can be the stimulus for us feeling a certain way, but never the cause. Quote, "We deny responsibility for our actions when we attribute their cause to factors outside ourselves," end quote. We often blame what we did on many outside factors like the actions of others, social pressures, norms and roles, or our personal labels, diagnoses, identity, or past history. But the fact is, denying our personal responsibility for our feelings and actions makes us dangerous. In her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, the author Hannah Arendt reported how the Nazi Adolf Eichmann and his fellow officers used responsibility-denying language called Amtssprache, loosely translated bureaucraties, to make their atrocious acts feel palatable. Although Eichmann was one of the chief organizers of the Holocaust, he claimed that he did only what he had to do, and he only did it for the reasons of fulfilling his duty, following orders, and obeying the law. Eichmann's attitude towards his actions made Hannah Arendt, at the end of her book, coin the phrase, "the banality of evil." Quote, "We can replace language that implies lack of choice with language that acknowledges choice," end quote. One example from the Nonviolent Communication book is a school teacher who hated grading her students because she felt like she was morally judging them. Yet Rosenberg said it was important for her to stop saying, "I have to give grades because it's the rules," and that she learned to say, "I choose to give grades because I want to keep my job." This simple shift in language acknowledged her choice and responsibility in the matter. In fact, she was giving grades in return for a benefit, not because she had to. By the way, the best book I've read about self-responsibility is Man's Search for Meaning, written by Viktor Frankl, a Jewish psychologist who survived the Holocaust concentration camps. And my favorite quote from that book is, everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's way." End quote. So make sure you check out and listen to our summary notes of that book in the future. That was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. So, a summary of this lesson. Recognize that outside factors can be a stimulus for what you do, but never the cause. This includes other people's actions, social expectations, and your past history. Denying self-responsibility for what we do and how we feel makes us dangerous. Now, lesson four. The first step is making observations, not evaluations. So now we'll be diving into the core of nonviolent communication, and it's fairly straightforward. There are only four parts to it. One is observations, two, feelings, three, needs, and four, requests. And here is a quick explanation of how these four parts work in order, and this is a quote from the author. First, we observe what is actually happening in a situation. What are we observing others saying or doing that is either enriching or not enriching our life? The trick is to be able to articulate this observation without introducing any judgment or evaluation, to simply say what people are doing that we either like or don't like. Next, we state how we feel when we observe this action. Are we hurt, scared, joyful, amused, irritated? And thirdly, we say what needs of ours are connected to the feelings we have identified. End quote. So, when you are communicating nonviolently, you just have to say those four parts in order. Again, that's observations, feelings, needs, and requests. Don't worry, we'll be going really deep into exactly what all these mean and how to do this. Right now, we will first focus on making observations, which is the first part of this whole process. So most of us might think that we know how to make observations, but the problem is that when we try to do it, we usually mix in our evaluations. Our evaluations are not the facts of what happened, but they are our judgments, criticisms, and other ways of analyzing what happened. So the way to communicate in a nonviolent way is to first separate our observations from our evaluations. And when we do this, the person we're talking to is far less likely to become defensive and resistant. And this means we can solve our interpersonal issues more quickly and straightforwardly. Here's an example. Marshall Rosenberg was called in one day to resolve an issue between the staff and principal of a school. First, he talked to the staff, asking them what the principal was doing that was preventing them from meeting their needs. One person quickly blurted out, "He has a big mouth." And Rosenberg had to explain to everyone that that was not an observation, but an interpretation and a value judgment of the person. Another teacher remarked, "He talks too much," which, again, was not an observation of a specific behavior, but an evaluation of how much the principal talked. So another chimed in, "He thinks only he has something worth saying." And that, again, was not an observation, but a guess of what this person is thinking or desiring. So after some time, the staff and Rosenberg worked together to create a list of behaviors the principal did that bothered them. This list was made up of descriptions of specific behaviors without judgments or evaluations attached to those behaviors. For example, the principal often brought up stories from his childhood in staff meetings, which often caused the meetings to run 20 minutes over time. And when that observation of a specific behavior was communicated to the principal, he exclaimed, "Why did nobody ever tell me?" So a summary of this lesson, the four parts of nonviolent communication are observations, feelings, needs, and requests. The first part of this is communicating your observations of specific behaviors the other person did without mixing in your evaluations, interpretations, or judgments about that behavior. And now lesson five, this is the second step, which is revealing feelings, not opinions. So after making an observation, you have to express your feelings about what you observed. And like the previous step, this is a little trickier than it first sounds. See, when most of us think we're expressing our feelings, what we're really doing is saying our opinions, interpretations, and assessments about others. A big reason for this confusion is the English language itself. We often begin sentences with the words "I feel," but don't end up expressing our inner feelings at all. For example, all these following statements are not expressions of inner feeling, but interpretations of people's behavior. I feel Jerry is being rude. I feel that people should be nice. And I feel like you don't take me seriously. Now, there are also statements like "I feel ignored" that are also not expressions of a feeling either. You see, being ignored can feel like a negative thing if you want it to be noticed, but it could also be a positive thing if you don't want attention. So the right way to express your feeling in that kind of situation is, "I feel hurt that no one talked to me." Hurt is an inner feeling, while ignored is not a feeling. And neither are words like abandoned, abused, cheated, diminished, ignored, manipulated, misunderstood, pressured, rejected, threatened, unwanted, or used. So, what words do express an inner feeling? Well, here's two short lists of positive and negative feelings to give you a quick idea. So first, the positive feelings: amused, appreciative, astonished, calm, comfortable, confident, elated, excited, glad, grateful, hopeful, loving, mellow, optimistic, refreshed, relaxed, warm. Now, negative feelings: afraid, angry, annoyed, ashamed, cold, disappointed, discouraged, disgusted, dull, embarrassed, helpless, hurt, jealous, overwhelmed, reluctant, sad, or worried. In summary, most of us don't express our feelings, but our opinions, interpretations, and assessments of others. As a general rule, make sure you follow the words "I feel" with an actual inner feeling like sad, not saying things like "I feel like this" or "I feel that," which are generally interpretations. Now, lesson six. This is the third step, communicating needs, not criticism. Next, we must connect our feelings to our unmet needs. At the root of our feelings, there is always a need. If we feel great, it's because our needs are being met, while if we feel bad, it's because our needs are not being met. Now, people have many natural needs. We have needs for safety, health, respect, love, trust, warmth, autonomy, understanding, intimacy, support, fun, and many others. Maslow's hierarchy of needs gives a great overview of that, and I'm sure you've seen that before. That's that pyramid that Abraham Maslow made, and at the bottom of the pyramid, there's physiological needs people have, like food and water. Then it goes up to emotional needs, like friendships and intimate relationships, and then to self-esteem needs and self-actualization needs at the top of the pyramid. So the problem is that when one of our needs is not being met, most of us never learned how to communicate that. So we're more likely to judge, criticize, or diagnose the people around us in an attempt to change their behavior. Here's a quote: "Analyses of others are actually expressions of our own needs and values," end quote. So what's the difference between communicating a need and saying a criticism? Well, imagine a wife is upset because her husband is working late every evening, and she says, "You care about your work more than me." That is criticism, and it's likely to provoke defensiveness. On the other hand, she could say, "I feel lonely because I need more connection and intimacy." With this sentence, she is revealing her feeling, loneliness, and then connecting that to an unmet need of hers, and that means she can communicate without criticizing the other person. A good formula to follow is, I feel ABC because I need XYZ. Now, make sure you absolutely avoid saying, I feel ABC because you did XYZ. Because that goes back to blaming the other person for how we feel. But when you say, I feel this because I need this, then you're simply recognizing, owning, and clearly communicating your own needs, and the other person is not going to get offended. In summary, we must connect our feelings with our unmet needs. We all have needs for love, respect, safety, and so on. A good formula to follow is, I feel ABC because I need XYZ. This allows us to communicate our unmet needs without criticizing or blaming the other person. Now, lesson 7, the fourth step, making requests, not demands. The last step of nonviolent communication is making requests. This is when you tell the other person exactly what they can do to meet your needs, and your requests must be concrete and specific. Often we make the mistake of asking someone to change using language that is too abstract and vague. At one of Marshall Rosenberg's workshops, he met a woman who was telling her husband, I want you to give me the freedom to grow and be myself. Well, an ambiguous statement like that will leave most people scratching their head as to what specific behaviors they should change. Also, unclear requests are very likely to provoke resistance and counterarguments like, but I do give you lots of freedom. Rosenberg asked the woman more questions to clarify what specific behaviors she wanted to see from her husband. She struggled for a few minutes and finally admitted, I guess I want him to smile no matter what I do and say it is okay. And when she could finally express what she really wanted in clear and concrete terms, the woman realized that her request left her husband little freedom to be himself in the relationship and have his own needs respected. Here's a quote. Often the use of vague and abstract language can mask oppressive interpersonal games. End quote. So another part of making effective requests is to avoid demanding the other person do what you want. The difference between a request and a demand is that demands make the other person believe they will be punished if they don't do what we say. So we should make it clear to the other person that we only want them to do or to follow our request if they can do so of their own free will. You will not punish them in any way if they don't comply. Why? Well, because when people follow our requests out of guilt or fear of punishment, then the relationship will have a growing resentment. It's much better they follow our request out of compassion and consideration and a personal connection to us. So to avoid making demands, be very aware when you begin having thoughts like, he should do this, or she is supposed to do that, or I deserve this. This kind of thinking will make it sound like you're demanding a certain behavior out of duty, obligation, or hidden reciprocity. So, I hope you're getting a sense of the overall formula by now. In a nutshell, nonviolent communication is saying this. When this happens, then I feel this because I need this. So, I would like you to do this instead. And if someone says no to your request, well, it doesn't mean you should give up right away, but first you should fully empathize with what is stopping them from saying yes before engaging in further persuasion. In summary, the last step of nonviolent communication is making a request. This means telling someone what they can do to meet our needs. Use concrete language to describe specific behaviors, and make sure they know you're not demanding or threatening punishment if they don't do what you say. Now, lesson 8. Give empathy first, not advice or reassurance. So we've spent a lot of time now exploring how to express ourselves better and more clearly. Now we'll switch focus and learn how to receive other people's messages and communication. The most important part of receiving others is to always begin with empathy. When other people confide in us, many of us have a knee-jerk response of offering them advice or reassurance. And that may be our attempt to fix whatever problem is bothering them. Yet, much of the time, when someone discloses their feelings to us, what they are really needing is empathy. So it's always better to ask before giving advice or reassurance, because that's often not what the other person is needing. Marshall Rosenberg was sitting in his kitchen one morning when suddenly his daughter walked downstairs. She looked in the mirror and she said that she was as ugly as a pig. He heard this and declared that she was the most gorgeous lady in the world. Now, that comment just seemed to make her feel even worse than she did before, and she ran back upstairs. He realized in that moment that what his daughter probably needed was not reassurance, but empathy. So he could have asked, "Do you feel bad about how you look today?" So the most important part of empathy is being present with the other person and with what they are feeling. This is not about intellectually understanding their situation. In fact, Rosenberg says that when a psychologist is too busy intellectually understanding their client's situation or connecting it to a psychology theory, that can really stop empathy from happening. Now, you'll know the other person has received enough empathy when they stop sharing with you and they look visibly relieved. So when they're done sharing and when they look visibly relieved, at that point, they will now be open and prepared to maybe hear your own feelings and needs, you know, if you're having some kind of conflict or situation. In summary, when others disclose their feelings to you, it's always best to start with empathy. That requires you to be present with the other person rather than intellectually understanding their situation. And it's always better to ask before offering advice or reassurance. And now lesson 9. To diffuse anger, reflect back messages charged with emotion. A great tool for showing empathy is paraphrasing. That means reflecting back what the other person just said in a way that demonstrates you understand. For example, if your child says, "I hate school," then you can reply, "Are you feeling sad because you're not enjoying your classes?" And that type of question lets the other person either agree that you understand or they will clarify what they really meant. So when you're confronted by an angry person, this tool can be especially helpful. Our typical response when someone is angry to us is often to deflect the blame and to say, "But it's not my fault," or "But I didn't mean to," or something similar. And that is usually the wrong move. Rosenberg jokes that we should never put our butt in the face of an angry person. And the proper response to diffuse anger is to empathize. A young woman was working at a drug detox center in Toronto. Late one night, a man who'd clearly taken drugs walked in and demanded a room. When she began explaining all the rooms were full, the man jumped on her, pinned her to the floor by sitting on her chest, and brought a knife to her throat, shouting, "Don't lie to me, you do have a room." The woman remembered the nonviolent communication training she'd taken just a few weeks before and knew that she had to respond with empathy rather than argument. So she listened for the feelings and needs underneath the man's words and said, "It sounds like you're really angry and want a room." The man replied that he may be an addict, but he deserves respect, damn it. And the woman continued to reflect that back, saying, "Are you mad not getting the respect you want?" This went on for a while longer, and the empathy was clearly diffusing the man's anger. Eventually, he got up off her, and the woman helped him find a room in another center. She was certain that if she'd responded with something like, "But the rooms really are full," then the man would have slit her throat. So, a summary of this lesson: The best way to respond to anger and other emotionally charged messages is with empathy, not argument. Paraphrase what they said to reflect back their feelings. And once they feel a little understood, they usually calm down. So now lesson 10, to handle criticism, hear the unmet needs beneath it. Marshall Rosenberg says there are four ways we can handle criticism. Number one is we can blame ourselves and accept the person's judgment. That often comes at a great cost to our own self-esteem. You know, we can say, yeah, I should have been more thoughtful. Number two, we could blame the other person, deflecting the criticism back at them. You know, we could say, no, you should be the one that is less sensitive. Or number three, we can express our own feelings and needs at that moment when we're being criticized. For example, we can say, when you say I'm too demanding, I feel terrible because I need this. Or number four, we can try to coax the other person to express their feelings and needs. So for example, we can say to them, are you feeling bad because you needed this? So, saying that a different way, in the face of any criticism or other negative message, our best option is to always look past the inflammatory words to the unmet needs beneath the words. For example, if your partner calls you lazy, you could accept that judgment and feel shame, or you could call them a bad name in return, which solves nothing, or you can look for the needs underneath those words that are not being met. So you could say, are you saying I'm lazy because you need less feeling of chaos and disorder in our living space? So here's a quote. A basic premise of nonviolent communication is that whenever we imply that someone is wrong or bad, what we are really saying is that he or she is not acting in harmony with our needs. End quote. Criticism, judgment, anger, the silent treatment, rolling eyes, underneath any of these negative messages, there is an ineffective attempt to get a need met. So rather than taking those messages personally, we can instead shine the light of our attention to what either we or the other person is feeling and needing at that moment. And once the other person is clear that we understand their unmet needs, then it's usually straightforward to solve the underlying issue. And these games of arguing and criticizing and indirect manipulation can be left behind. By the way, a great book for learning how to handle criticism better is The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. One of the top lessons from that book is to never take things personally. So make sure you check out our summary notes of that book as well. It's called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. In summary, when you're faced with criticism, you can either blame yourself and feel bad, blame the other person and accomplish nothing, or you can listen to the unmet needs beneath their words. The last option is by far the most productive. Now, lesson 11, don't punish kids, rather educate them towards positive values. Some parents say that punishment is the only way they can make their kids do what is good for them. Punishment may include corporal force, judgmental criticism, or taking away privileges. Now, while punishment may be successful in altering behavior in the short term, it can often fail when it comes to your more important long-term goals as a parent. If all you're asking is, what do I want my kids to do now, then punishment can seem to work. But if you ask the question, what do I want my kids' reasons to be for doing this, then punishment can often be counterproductive. See, when someone is motivated to do an action out of fear, they often become blind to the more important reasons for doing that action, like the intrinsic rewards or the long-term benefits in that activity. For example, would you want your kids to read books because they love to learn, or because they are afraid they'll be punished if they don't? Beyond that, when you are controlling someone's behavior through fear or force, that often lowers their self-esteem and goodwill towards you. Being forced to do anything out of fear creates a resistance towards that very activity and hostility towards the person enforcing the punishment. Worst of all, a threat of punishment can even make kids blind to the underlying compassion that motivates these parental demands. So you may be solving one problem, but you're creating many other ones. In summary, motivating kids through threat can be counterproductive. It can work in the short term, but make them blind to the intrinsic benefits or long-term benefits of whatever activity you're wanting them to do. So that's all for this summary of nonviolent communication. Hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you'll be, from now on, starting to use this four-step framework in your communication to help yourself to have more healthy relationships. And I'll see you in the next book note.